Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Sian Wickersham and Tom Breeze. Pupil health and well-being with Drs. Chris and Susie Peach. Hello and a warm welcome back to the podcast where Sian Wickersham is standing in for Emma. Welcome, Sian.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, everybody.
Nice to have you here as well. And we have some guests who, once again, we're aiming for the distance record, I think, for guests. More guests from Scotland. We've got Chris and Susie Peach with us. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for coming all this way. I suppose before we start and explain why we've dragged you all the way from Scotland, would you like to explain kind of who you are and what you do? Because you're not actually teachers.
No. So I'll go first, and I'm getting the nod from Susie. So we are both doctors, and I'll let Susie tell her story. I am an occupational health doctor, or we call them occupational health physicians. And we have created a digital health and wellbeing education program designed for secondary schools. And so that's the real purpose why we're coming down to chat to you today on the show. My background, as I said, is an occupational health doctor, but I originally started out as an officer in the British Army. I was in the Royal Engineers and became a bomb disposal officer, and then left and realized my interest to in medicine. And so therefore pursued that, had to go back to school. I went to the College of West Anglia and did my my A-levels on this occasion, and to get into university, and that's where I embarked upon my medical career. Initially, I wanted to do general surgery, very interested in the surgical side from my previous experience in trauma, and then realized partway through my training that I didn't actually want to be the surgeon as the full career, and then explored a bit of emergency medicine for a while before settling on occupational health. And so that's the brief potted history of my career. Over to Susie.
Well, mine is a bit more straightforward, I must say.
No bombs involved.
No. My interest in medicine has always been at the kind of polar extremes. So I have a big interest in paediatrics and adolescent health and in palliation. I thought I wanted to be a paediatrician and did a few years in paediatrics, and then basically decided, no, I want to do the full spectrum. So I went on trained to be a GP and was a GP partner for about 6 or 7 years. Can't exactly remember, time flies. And it was during that time that this idea came to me. And it came from frustration. I was realizing that every day I was seeing more and more young people who were coming in with quite bizarre ideas about their health sometimes, and a lot of anxiety and a lot of problems that actually they shouldn't really have at that age, because they should be the most well group of society. And it shouldn't be that more than 50% of my consultations are with people under 25, but that was the reality.
Wow, that's an incredible stat.
And it might be also that, was it because I was the young GP? Was it, you know, were they coming to me? Is that a reflection of everyone's statistics? Probably not. But I still was aware that there was an issue here. And I found myself every day saying the same really basic things about health, you know, explaining what a virus and a bacteria is and why an antibiotic works for one and not the other. And, you know, what the debunking the crazy myths about contraception and teaching just real basics. What's your normal anatomy? And just calming people down and trying to demedicalize them, because they were coming in with quite niche ideas about what they thought was wrong with them and diagnosing themselves. And when you unpicked it, you could then actually help them fully. So I just thought and said to you one day, I was on maternity leave with our second baby, and I said, can we do something where we go into schools and just give our knowledge across as healthcare professionals from our perspective what's missing? And that's how the idea started. And when we started testing that with schools, it was actually the feedback we got from schools that said, can you make this a digital product that we can tap into when we need it? And it sort of evolved from there. So from a medical perspective, we're both still practicing, but much less so than ever before, because we truly believe in this and really want to give it a go.
Yeah, and I think, you know, similarly in my practice in occupational health, I see the slightly older portion of our society, you know, in the working age population, but that can include, you know, apprentices at, you know, age 16 and plus. And I kept hearing as well similar problems from employers that this group of, you know, our society going into the working, you know, population are sort of ill prepared, you know, have a lot of gaps in their life skill knowledge, you know, how to handle and navigate, you know, world as an independent adult. And they were looking, I remember one employer sort of actively looking to recruit teachers to help teach life skills. And that was the sort of, you know, headline that came back. And I, again, in my clinics, I would see people, but not just at the young age, but all the way into their 30s, 40s and 50s, still with some crazy ideas about health, which caused them to run into problems which really could have been prevented. So if they just had the right knowledge, if they just had the good foundation, they could have helped themselves, or at least known how to find help sooner if it did become a problem. So again, same ideas, same issues. And we thought, well, it's good as a doctor at an individual level to have an intervention, so to speak, to someone to help them. But what about everybody else? You know, you know, for every one person who comes with a problem, you know, there's many others out there having similar issues. So we started to think about, well, how can we help more people, and how can we help before the problems start? Because medicine, as you may know, is very reactive still. You know, we talk about prevention and health promotion, but it's still a very reactive, and that's fine, because things will happen, problems go wrong, people need fixed, and that won't change. But what we saw is these are preventable, so why don't we get into truly the prevention and promotion space, and how can we best achieve that? So we realized we need to come out of our medical domain, if you like, out of our clinics, and take it far more into the education space. And we know that early intervention works, and we also know that health and well-being is directly linked to educational attainment. So we stand to help, you know, the teaching profession by taking this, our medical knowledge, into that space to help people when they're at that critical time in their life, you know. So,
and can I be really clear when I said people were coming with bizarre ideas? And I'm not actually, I'm not in any way criticizing the schools turning that out, because that's not the case. And like we said, I don't feel that it's the school's responsibility to teach on these things, but society has changed, and there's many reasons for that, and we can delve into that if you like. But a lot of young people obviously are exposed to the internet and social media and the vast amount of misinformation on there, and we want to be more the counterbalance to that. And the reason we've gone for schools is exactly as you've said, as a more strategic intervention, but not to help with their health, not because we think we're better than schools, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Am I being clear about that?
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely clear.
Yeah, and it's all about that sort of helping them to be in a position that's they're optimal for learning. And if we can educate and individuals to, you know, empower them to make their better health decisions through giving them the facts, the accurate information, then they can make better decisions that will ultimately improve their health. So there's always going to be a gap, you know, depending on people's upbringings for various reasons, the hand of cards that they've been dealt in the early days of their lives. But some of that they can take power back, and, you know, by reversing through the right knowledge and awareness and skills. So that's where we're coming in with the sort of product we're offering here is to empower, to enable, to ultimately improve health literacy so that they can be the best possible best possible state for learning, and it's a supportive mechanism, because teachers have an incredible amount of pressure to deliver across all these areas, and often look to solve these problems, and it shouldn't be the teaching, you know, fraternity's responsibility, and it can't be, you know, there's only so much. So we're trying to say, well, look, we've got something that can help, you know, and support you when you're already under so much pressure. So that's the kind of concept that we're coming at.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're totally right that often these things fall to schools because they're the sort of frontline person, along with the GPs and other kind of emergency services, where when someone presents with a problem, often it'll be the school that notices first. So you do end up in this role of teacher, of social worker, of psychologist, of counsellor. And, you know, when do we get to the learning? Like, and that's where what really teachers should be doing is focusing on that learning. And it's very hard to do. And it also, I think, varies, doesn't it, school to school, whereby I like the way you phrased it, the hand of cards that have been dealt. Sometimes you'll be working in a school where there's lots of children that have been dealt a really hard hand of cards. And actually, a lot of your time is going to be spent on that stuff that then perhaps could have an impact on outcomes, have an impact on the quality of the education, because we're stretched, we're doing this stuff. And it's not necessarily getting better, is it? So yeah, I am interested that you said society has changed. Like, why do you think that this is such a big problem today? Like, what's different today than maybe 20 years ago?
The internet. I mean, we're living in a time where we have access to more information than we've ever had before. So you would expect, therefore, that society would be more advanced and actually know more, you know? And that doesn't seem to be the case. And I think it's information overload and also the incorrect nature of the information that they're getting. So we talk about misinformation and disinformation. You probably may or may not know the difference, but correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, disinformation is with malice, essentially.
Explain it better. Disinformation is, you know, it's deliberate. It's designed to fulfill another agenda, you know, for one reason or another. Whereas misinformation, it can be someone who genuinely believes that what they're saying is correct. And it may be for, you know, for altruistic purposes, you know, but has for one reason or another lacks context or is misusing the facts unbeknownst to themselves. So that's quite even more dangerous because people can be really championing an idea or a concept but using it incorrectly. So misinformation, you know, it happens by accident as, you know, as well. And you know, when you're at that critical time in your life where you're trying to, you know, think about becoming a young adult and forming your opinions and there's so much information, as Susie said, overload. It's, you know, even more difficult to try and discern for yourself what's correct, what's right, what's accurate, what's true, what's false.
It's also really normal, you know, psychologically for young people to distrust the adults that are in their life. And that's why teenagers obviously move away from their parents and they look for other voices. From an evolutionary standpoint, that makes sense. But now those other voices quite often are influencers. And it's not the loudest, it's not the most accurate or the most educated voices that get the most airtime, you know. And the other thing that plays into that is, of course, the algorithm on social media. So if you're watching a particular video, you will likely get more similar content. It'd be different people saying it, but it's the same message that's coming through repeatedly. So if you, as a young person, then think, well, I know this to be true because I've now watched 50 plus videos and they're all saying the same thing, then you don't get the other side of the argument. And they've coined that phrase filter bubble, because you're completely unaware of the information that you're not being exposed to, and that the fact that you are being filtered and you come away with quite biased views. And we certainly see that day to day, day in, day out in the clinic. There's something that's come from social media that someone's worried about that quite often is incorrect. And social media is such a beast that you can't analyse all of it for how correct or incorrect is it. But one of the most interesting studies that was done recently in 2023, it was Dublin City University teamed up with MyFitnessPal, and they used an AI algorithm, ironically, to analyse TikTok at that particular time for posts about nutrition. And they compared them with best practice. So anything that was completely false or just had no evidence at all for it was deemed as inaccurate. What percentage do you think was accurate?
Well, given that algorithms and social media seem to mainly reward outrage and dodgy information, the amount accurate, I'd say, I'm going to say 35%.
Oh, I was thinking much higher. I was going to go 60. Maybe I'm an optimist.
I am the podcast cynic.
2% was accurate.
Oh, 2%? Oh, my gosh. Enough. No, you're just cracked.
Yeah.
That is absolutely mad,
I mean, that's obviously
it?
A short snippet at that time, and it doesn't cover all the other topics that are discussed in social media, but it gives us an idea for how immense this situation is and what we're dealing with.
You see full-blown adults, don't you?
Absolutely.
Get sucked into this stuff.
I've been sucked alone. In.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, do I need this special cream for my face? No, you don't, Susie. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, so yeah, it's absolutely no wonder, is it, that young people are
very
susceptible to it, like without the kind of the critical thinking faculties that you develop as you become an adult. But even with that, you're still susceptible to it.
It's designed to be that way.
Yeah.
You know? One of the things that, you know, when you hear narratives about young people's health, there seems to be a sense that mental health is sort of, or issues with mental health seem to be galloping ahead, you know, that this seems to be an increasing issue. And when you read the commentary around it, I suppose, depending on which side of the spectrum of comment you're reading, it's either because, you know, the world is broken and the kids are living in a broken world, or because they're all just massive snowflakes and, you know, you go to the right wing press and it's just that everybody's a malingerer. But I mean, to what extent, because, you know, social media is the sort of elephant in the room, isn't it, to some extent. Is there anything else going on? I mean, if we were to set aside the sort of, you know, and I'm totally on board with social media will bring about the end of the world, I often tend to mention. But if we set that sort of beast aside, what else is there going on there? Because, I'm not hugely attracted by the sort of idea that kids are just massive snowflakes now.
No, me either.
Possibly more to it.
I don't know. I mean, I don't have the answer for you, but I do. A conversation that I had with our educational psychologist that developed a lot of the content in that area for PWA is I asked her about this, you know, because repeatedly schools are saying kids are not as resilient these days.
Yeah.
Why is that? Because they should be. And she had a really interesting argument with that. And she said kids actually are resilient in a different world. So previously, we had to be resilient to things like, you know, playing in the street and being street aware and all these things that actually aren't relevant now. Now, we have kids who are on devices many hours a day. In the UK, average for usage under 25 is 7 hours a day of internet usage, which equates to 2 days a week. It's insane. Yeah. They're being exposed to so much that they are having to filter internally. So they're having to filter their emotions. They're also exposed to a lot of bad news that we were kind of sheltered from. So they're resilient in a different way. I'm really aware that doesn't answer your question, Tom. I don't believe that they're snowflakes, but I do believe that they are living in a world that none of us lived in, and that we're not prepared as parents really to guide them through that. I don't know. Do you have another?
Yeah, and it kind of, there's an analogy I use which describes how, or a mechanism, you know, it's, I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's something that helps sort of frame the idea. So when consoles and computer games started to come out and they were a bit more interactive and playable, now before that, then my idea, this is how I frame it, is that you spent more time around the dinner table, you know, with your parents, if you had them, or even grandparents, you know, a second and third, you know, generations, you sort of by osmosis got that wisdom, that life skills, the comments, the communication, the direct, you know, in-person communication. As the computer game era started to grow, you disappeared away from the dinner table. You played in your room more, on your consoles, and maybe your friends came around and you could still have social relationships, but then quickly that moved onto internet. You didn't have to be in the same room as somebody to play multiplayer games, and you were no longer at that dinner table getting that sort of distilled wisdom in one form or another. And then you grew up and then you have kids, so, and you know, and then you lack some of that wisdom, or you might lack some of that wisdom, and that's sort of where the gap started for me, started to grow. And so therefore we are, and the rate and the pace of change, as Susie mentioned now with information, even if you are the most tech savvy parent or individual, it's difficult to keep up. It's difficult to know what is the right thing to do, and really difficult to understand what, you know, what are the real challenges, you know, that young people are facing, and is that going to be even more different for the next generation after that? You know, probably. So it's complex, you know.
I don't love the snowflake thing because I just feel that's the older generation criticizing the younger generation. There's always something, isn't there? I mean, in medicine, we got it all the time, didn't we, in hospital? Oh, well, we never did that shift pattern in my day. We used to work 27 hours a day. And you'd be like, oh, Yeah. No, there's always something. Yeah. We'd had it harder.
As well, if there's a bit of an inequity issue creeping in. Just thinking about the around the dinner table thing, the screen time thing. And there's a bit of a sort of middle class moral panic about screen time at the moment, isn't there? And it could well be, I mean, you know, you've got to be really careful not to generalise, but it could well be that perhaps people from a less sort of affluent background may not have room for a dinner table, parents might be out working shifts or whatever it may be. And there's that sort of, you know, maybe more likely to have a higher level of education if they come from a more affluent background and be aware of certain things or be able to contradict certain things. And you wonder whether that's yet another inequity creeping into young people's lives there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I use that analogy just as something to sort of illustrate the change that's happened. You know, it can't be applied to all households because, as we said, you know, people can grow up one without a parent. You know, the average of people growing up without, you know, an influential, you know, parent is increasing. You know, there's different family units now that exist that, you know, maybe didn't before. And, you know, society has changed, not just for the information age, but the way we live, you know, as families, as households. So it's complex. I don't think there is one right answer. Mm-hmm. There's a combination of all these things that play in that add to, you know, exacerbate, you know, inequalities, whether that's financial level or at the educational level, et cetera.
Coming back to your question, though, Tom, this thought's just come into my head about the mental health epidemic, which I do think is real. I think there is more mental health problems. There's definitely more recognition and more diagnosis and more intervention. There's also, in my experience, not speaking for everyone and every doctor, but in my experience, there's a lot of over-diagnosing of yourself. So there's a huge amount of young people coming in saying, this is my anxiety disorder, or, you know, this is my depression. And that, as a doctor, is really difficult because that's the opening statement. Previously, the opening statement would be something along the lines of, I've been feeling a little bit low and I've been this and I've been next thing and this happened. Trying to unpick someone that's put themselves in a box is really difficult. And you have to work really hard on your communication skills with that to get them back to, okay, what is happening in your life? How exactly are you feeling on a day-to-day basis? And I get it, you know, they want to be recognised, they want the help. So and again, some of the misinformation online feeds into that. But it's not helpful because a lot of the time, again, in my experience, it's not an anxiety disorder. It's not depression. It's a reactive mood problem because life's a bit crappy right now. And, you know, when life's a bit crappy, you're supposed to feel a bit down. And that's okay. And it's about normalising and really going back to, what are our normal emotions and our thoughts and our behaviours and how are they linked and what can we do about it before it then actually accelerates and becomes a problem later on? And people want quick fixes. That's the other thing that's happened with society. Now, I can't believe we haven't mentioned that. You know, I think about this often when I forget that I've got something to do and quickly order something on Amazon. We're used as a society to rapidly getting what we need. There's less forward thinking going into things now. And, you know, I need something for a party I'm going to tomorrow, Amazon next day delivery, for example. And the virtue of patience, I think, has been lost a lot in all generations. But certainly if you grew up with that, how can you ever really possibly know that there's another way to be? And that is reflected in health. They often come in wanting very quick fixes.
Yeah, I'd be interested to talk more, I think, about how health and education work together at the moment. Because obviously in Wales, we have the Curriculum for Wales and we have an area of learning and experience, which is our health and wellbeing learning and experience. Sure. And it's also one of our four purposes, healthy, confident individuals. And in Scotland, I know it's very, very similar, but obviously slightly different. So schools are aware of this health stuff, aren't they? It's not that this is new. And we're all working to develop health and wellbeing within our schools and within our learners, but it's not working really, or it's not working at the level to which we would like it to.
Yeah.
So yeah, in terms of the kind of interplay between health and education, how do you see, what could we do to improve that, to make that better?
That's a mega question.
You're welcome.
I mean, obviously it's difficult as teachers working on the front line and then as doctors working in the front line, there's not a lot of actual day-to-day work or communication. I personally love it when I have to phone a school to find out about it. And I'd like getting right down to the nitty-gritty, you know, what exactly is going on with this kid? How is their attention in the classroom and all that kind of stuff? But that's about the extent of it in my career up till now. Mm. Obviously, you have government bodies and public health as an institution are responsible for guiding policy when it comes to public health intervention and education around health. We're not public health doctors, so no. I don't know a lot about it. I do know that we have a public health doctor that's helped curate our critical appraisal content for the programme, and she thinks what we're doing is excellent. So there must be something in it. Yeah. What's going on more than that at the moment, I honestly don't know. And I do think that it's a lot of pressure to put on schools to expect them to teach expert level health when they're already trying to teach their own subjects and have so many other roles within the school to do.
And I think it's about, what have we identified as the, what's the practical problem here? You know, so I think there's talk about, cross-discipline working, that we should, across departments, across disciplines, be working more together and collaborating better. Yeah, absolutely. But as Susie kind of mentioned, there's the pressures that exist, which, allow you to really firefight from day to day and work within your area without then thinking, well, how can I better collaborate? And I know, there are people out there doing that, but it's not wholesale available across. And that's the point, is that how do you get this out to the masses? So we've just identified that, teachers are under a lot of pressure. Funding pressures mean that there's less teaching assistance. There's increasing pressure to get the grades, the measured outcomes for schools, and to get people onto higher education and to improve attendance. So that's where we want to try and offload that pressure and say, well, here's that collaboration. Here, take the people who do this for a living, all the experts, bring it in and provide a resource that means that you're not having to learn about it. You can use it. You can just tap into it. And, within our program, we provide sort of teaching guides, learning guides, how they can then integrate that into their classroom. So really just trying to offload the burden on teachers, for head teachers who have got stressed staff, then hopefully that will help. For those teachers who struggle to know how to deliver this, here's a framework, here's a curriculum that you can help. And you can, if you're very involved, you can integrate it with whatever you have. If you're not, if you've not got much of a program, then this can serve as a base theory and a basis of support for you.
Yeah. I think you need to be clear about that, because it's completely self-directed.
Yeah.
Because some teachers just don't want to teach this at all, and they don't have to, because the young person works their way through it.
Yes.
The lesson guides are there for schools that want to take it that bit further and integrate and have more conversations and activities in the classroom. And as a medic, I love, obviously, that health and wellbeing is such a big part of the curriculums, right? Mm-hmm. Because it does, we're incredibly biased, but it does underpin everything that we are, our mental health, our physical health, how we interact with the world is critical to everything that we do and how, like you say, how able we are to learn. So that is fantastic to see it there. But yeah, I wouldn't like to be in a teacher's shoes right now trying to deliver a lot of this, because it cannot be easy.
No, I was just thinking what you were saying there about the, and both of you have kind of hinted at it, the whole sort of schools getting judged on results, maybe pupils feeling under pressure to get results, those in inverted commas, the high flying pupils, maybe they're getting a lot of pressure from home, maybe they put a lot of pressure on themselves, maybe they've got a lot of pressure in school. I mean, nobody would ever be like this, but let's imagine a really caricatured line of thought here. Nobody would ever admit to this line of thought, but secondary schools in particular kind of live or die by their results. Some pupils probably feel that they live or die by their results. You could end up thinking, oh, well, there's no prizes for worrying about people's well-being. We've just got to get the results out of them. Nobody would go that far, but you can sort of find yourself accidentally in that sort of ballpark a little bit. And you did sort of say earlier on there was a link between health and well-being and outcomes. So What would be the kind of, what would be the answer or the riposte, I suppose, to anybody that was getting themselves in that place of like, well, actually, you know, we haven't got the time or the space or the luxury of worrying about well-being because it's all about the grades, whether that's a, you know, a teacher or a pupil or a parent.
Mm-hmm. I would say to an adult, have you ever been in a situation where you're overworked and you constantly, because you have something, you've got a deadline at work, you've got an exam and you're just work. How did you feel? In retrospect, did you feel like you were able to make good decisions? Were you in a creative space? What was your problem-solving ability? How emotionally resilient were you? Were you calm? Were you reasonable? And, you know, what were you doing? Were you taking the time out to make sure you were getting, you were eating well and you were spending time with friends and family and you were exercising? These are the things, the absolute basics of health, that if we do well, we're in a better place to fully use our higher cognitive functions. We know this. If you're in the stress response too much, your prefrontal cortex shuts down. You're not able to problem solve and critically appraise. These are basic things that we all know. Yet, yeah, there's so much pressure put on some teenagers externally and internally to just focus purely on that and forget the basics. And my argument would always be, if you get that right, you will get not only better results, but you'll get more resilient and calmer, happier children.
Yeah, yeah. So the answer is that, you know, it's totally understandable how they end up in that position, yeah. Because that's the focus. That's the most, you know, the obvious thing banging on the door. But if you pay a bit of attention to this this area, then in time, you know, because this doesn't happen overnight, it's not fixed overnight, but in time, all those things that you are measuring should improve, because there is, you know, there's a proven link between health and well-being and educational attainment, but it does take time to take effect. You know, you can't expect to say, right, we've got this in, and next year it'll all be better. No, it takes time, because, you know, that's, you know, one pupil starts in their journey and has anything between, what do we say, 4 and 6 years in their secondary school. So, you know, obviously the earlier you can start that positive change, the better. But It does. You have to take, if you just ignore it, nothing will change. You know, you're still going to be fighting those fires in 10 years' time. So it's about having that courage to apportion some more energy in this sort of not as tangible area right now, because it's not as tangible as your marks and your grades, but to know that if you do and consistently make those improvements, small improvements across all these different areas, you'll start to see, you know, by default, you'll start to see change and improvement in the areas that you are measuring. So it's that investment, it's having a bit of vision to say, I know this is important, I shouldn't ignore it, I should put some energy, some time into it. Again, very easy for me to say, but difficult for, you know, a head teacher who is, you know, all money, all resources have been assigned to those priorities.
You know, presumably, so it has to be a holistic thing and not a compulsory resilience period 5 on a Friday afternoon and never nowhere else in the time.
Yeah. A tick box, we're doing this thing.
Yeah, right.
Again, exactly. We see it in medicine. We know, you know, we're also in a very pressured career and you're firefighting often, and it's not, I wouldn't be able to spend an hour educating a 15-year-old that comes out about all their choices. It's just quickly, right, let's deal with, you know, crocodile closest to the boat. And The measured outcomes that we have, we know that there was a big shift in the GP contract 10 years or so ago. I can't actually remember exactly when, where they wanted us to change how the payment would come to the practice based on certain things that had to be documented. You know, what exactly was that person's blood pressure? And some GPs at that time shifted away from providing other care and really heavily focused on this, because this is what they were being rewarded with.
Sounds
to
familiar.
The detriment of some other areas of care. It's a yeah. perfect example for us that absolutely happens in the education space too. Wait, if you can understand, and there is no perfect answer here, but we need to help the
health. Very hard, isn't it, to focus on something that you may not see the results of for 5 or 6 years. And in the kind of pendulum swing of education policy as well, who knows what that is going to look like? Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. It needs bravery, doesn't it? It takes a brave teacher and a brave school leader to say, actually, I think this is really important. I'm going to focus on this now. And then when these 11-year-olds are 16, they're going to not only have better results, hopefully, but also just be in that more kind of well-rounded place, better able to take on the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's a structural change, mm-hmm. a societal change. Mm-hmm. We're tanker turning, aren't we? We're not. Mm. It's not a quick fix.
No, it's not.
Yeah. So I suppose we've been around the houses now about all sorts of massive, meaty problems, but we haven't actually given you the opportunity to tell us what it was that you actually created in
order
to solve this. You know, and thank goodness you have, because I certainly have very fond memories of having a gap in my timetable and being given PSE with the bottom set of year nine. And that was genuinely an entertaining hour, if slightly concerning for the future of humanity. So what was your response to discovering this problem? What is it that you have created?
Yeah, so as I say, it started off with let's bring our knowledge to schools, and over the last few years, we're talking 3 years now, it's now become what it is. And essentially we sat down together and said, what do we feel young people need? What are the knowledge gaps? What are the problems that commonly affect them? And from a health perspective, we wrote all that down and had a bit of a rudimentary our own curriculum. And then we surveyed hundreds of teachers, healthcare professionals and teens from 11 to 18. And we said, are we missing anything? What's the most important thing? And made sure it was all there, basically. And started creating a platform from that. Mm-hmm. I'll let you tell the rest.
Yeah, so the sort of ethos behind it is that we're not, you know, we're not just one thing or one aspect. We're not just our mental health. You know, we're not just our physical health. We're not just us as an individual, you know, our engagement with the world. So it's that recognition that everything is interconnected. Yes, there might be some emphasis on some areas, but there are, you know, aspects, things that you do that affect your body will, you know, have that play forward and eventually affect your mental health, or the relationships that you have and the decisions that you make will affect both your mental health and physical health. So we wanted to create a program that wasn't sort of traditionally stovepiped in systems or and to allow that sort of understanding and recognition of that interconnectedness. But nevertheless, we had to come up with modules and ideas. So we came up with three themes, which is conversations with your body, conversations with yourself, and conversations with the world. And under those three themes sit our modules, if you like, which are subjects, you know. So sexual health, for instance, would sit under conversations with your body. And then mental health, or understanding your mental health, enhancing your mental health, would sit under, you know, the conversations with yourself. And then, excuse me, conversations with your world. You might have subjects, for instance, like substance abuse or substance use and addiction. So we wanted to create a structured program like that, but it's not start and finish. You don't start in one area and finish. It's also recognized that people, students, young people go through different events at different stages, even in the same year group, depending on their own personal circumstances or their own personal growth and development. So it's an asynchronous program. You can go in there, you can log on. Each student will essentially get a login. They can go on. And if you've ever used a learning management system before, where you have mandatory training modules to go through, you know, you have to quality and diversity, or, you know,
fire safety.
We all got told off yesterday because we haven't done fire safety. Exactly.
So you'll be familiar with those concepts. Yes. So it's a, you know, you get a login to your learning management system, and that, and then that contains all the modules. And
I'm worried that might tar us with a brush. No. It's a lot more fun than the standard one. Than fire safety.
I've just given you the structure, but it's essentially a repository of modules around these subjects, which you can go in and tackle at any time. And some things you have to obviously start at the start, and you'll get the basic concepts and then become more complex. But you can move around at your own pace. You can go away and come back from it. You can access it 24/7. So go back to that sex ed lesson when you're uncomfortable sitting in class with your peers. And anybody got any questions? Who's going to be brave enough to put their hand up and say, what about this? No. But when you're at home in the comfort of your own space, you can, when you're feeling more, less pressured, more able to learn, I'll look and I'll examine this a bit more, and I'll watch that video. Everything that we do, it recognizes, or in the platform recognizes the change, you know, the neurodevelopmental change in the way people learn now, and digital consumption behavior. So 95%, would you say, is video based. So it's short. It sort of recognizes that, you know, young people have short attention spans and get bored very easily. So lots of rapid scene changes. And the way in which we deliver the content, we feature probably one of our most important aspects, which is lived experience. So in these subject areas where we have somebody who's very, you know, kindly and bravely wanted to tell their story, they've been through something, we will start off with that as a case example and tell that story. Going back to what we mentioned earlier, young people might not necessarily want to hear be dictated to or told this is the way it is. Well, we don't. We share somebody's real life story, and that's powerful because it resonates with people. They can identify with that. And then we go on and use one of our, 30 or so experts we have now who will give the expert explanation of the distilled practical realities of that situation. And then we intersperse it with quizzes, which we know young people love from our research, to test their knowledge as to what they've picked up on and what they've learned, what they think they know and what they don't know. We throw in myth busting, single questions again, just to stimulate thought. And we have a journaling feature where we can ask them a question, ask them to think and then journal. And then that links in with what we also have as our global community. So this is a platform within that they can go in their respective year groups and talk further about these subjects which are covered. And we think that's a very powerful, aspect to allow them, and when they're feeling comfortable, to learn about these, which sometimes can be quite sensitive topics and subjects.
I think the community forum teachers also have access to a teaching version, so they can share resources internationally and feedback and, form lesson plans around that. And yeah, it's been designed so that it appeals to what the young people like based on all of our trials, and also to be self-directed so that teachers aren't carrying the burden of, okay, now great, you've got a sexual health consultant who's developed a module, how am I going to learn that and then deliver it? You don't have to. But we have produced accompanying lesson guides so that if you want to take it that step further, you could say, for example, I know some of our trial schools have said, go away and do this module on vaping in your own time, and then in class next week they can do one of the associated activities to just reinforce the learning there again.
And that's a recognition that we, we're a digital resource, but nothing beats in-person group activity. So no. This is how a school can integrate it with whatever program they have. And they may have really quite extensive programs in some cases, or they might have nothing much at all. But this gives them that ability to integrate it, as and when they need. And we mentioned that really important that the teachers, maybe guidance teachers, will then have this community space where they can go in and talk about these subjects, share best practice, share ideas. And similarly, that's the school product that we offer, where schools will sign up their student cohort. But we also have that where parents can, individually sign up their children. And again, they get access as well, free access as part of that, or, with a child's sign up. So because we know that parents have things to learn from this as well. And by having access to that same material, they can help and understand that journey that their child is going on. So we know that parents sometimes might feel lack of confidence as well, and a lack of knowing that they have gaps in their own knowledge. So this might help them to feel more able to speak, or empower them to have better communication and at home, whatever the home environment is.
I can't get the vision of this kid out of my head. One of our trial schools, and I was explaining roughly what we were doing, and this 13-year-old boy said to me, why don't you just use, how long have you been doing this for? Why don't you just get AI to do it, to deliver the knowledge? And I was like, this is before he saw it, by the way, in our defence. And I said, well, because the point is, we live in a time with AI. And yes, it could churn out the knowledge, but the whole point in this is, in the digital world, we are giving you real people and we're promoting real conversation. And that's why our themes are conversations with, the community forum is called conversations with each other. It's conversations with your body, conversation, because we need more of that as a society, and we need real people's stories, and AI cannot generate that. This is the human part that we want to showcase. And even in the expert videos, there's a piece of research that was done by Scottish Government last year that basically the outcome is young people don't trust healthcare professionals to give them accurate health information anymore. They trust influencers. And they will trust an influencer more if they're in a natural setting with a cup of tea. So we've made sure that when we film with our experts, it's in our home or their home, and it's in a kitchen and there's stuff in the background and it looks normal. And we've asked them to be as relaxed and normal as possible. And that went down well in the trials. But I will say, when we first put this in front of secondary school students, we were nervous. And
I bet
they came in.
Like no one else.
Yes, it was exactly. every year group. It was assessed with every year group across four schools, and all of the pastoral care and guidance teachers, and everyone had their say. And the first group that came into the school that I was at, there was a lot of, oh, what the hell is this? This is rubbish. Oh, what are they making us do now? And within 5 minutes, there was silence. Mm. And the thing that silenced them was the real story. Because you can't deny, you can say, oh, I don't like that person who's telling me what to do. But you can't deny someone's real experience. And that's really powerful. And that's the bit that we're really proud of. Mm. And always on the lookout for real stories if anyone wants to share.
Yeah, I think I've got 100 questions from a learning design perspective, but I think I might spare the listeners the learning design questions. Yeah. But yeah, it sounds like that's the trouble, isn't it, with these online platforms, is actually getting people to engage with them.
Absolutely.
Like, it can be the best stuff in the world. And I've done lots of these, you know, for teachers, lots of these kind of asynchronous sessions to help them with their questioning or whatever. And sometimes I'd go in and I'd look at the stats and it would be very depressing.
Yes.
You know, I spent 4 hours on this and one person has looked at it and things like that. But yeah, the fact that you've kind of built that in to your design of it, the kind of engagement bit, shows where we're at now, really, doesn't it? Like, we know this stuff. Mm-hmm. We can make this engaging and it's our responsibility to.
Yeah. I mean, we knew from the beginning that we never wanted to launch just with a course. Actually, we don't use the word course. Because it sounds terrible and people are like, oh God, I got to do this, sit down and do the whole thing. The lived experience interviews are all less than 5 minutes. The expert explanations, a few of them are about 9, but most of them are about 2 or 3 minutes. And you can pause and come out of that. And we were clear on that from the beginning. But the reason we launched with the community forum is because we know that that's probably what's going to bring them back. You know, if you're feeling vulnerable about something sensitive, vaginal discharge or something like that, you can discuss it in a safe place, and that's what you'll go back for, and that's therefore that ties in. The way we've structured the forum, it's all tied to the modules, so it kind of forces them to learn in lots of different ways without ramming it down their neck. What we've tried to do.
And I should add, actually, a very important point about the platform is that from the start we wanted students, you know, recognizing that these topics can be sensitive and you don't want to put your head above the parapet and nobody's going to put your hand up in the classroom. But we made it mandatory that students signing up to the platform will have an anonymous username. Mm-hmm. So when they use, or they're in any sort of, you know, what might be an inverted commas, a public space, so the community space, they will be anonymous. They will have an anonymous username. And part of the terms and conditions and use of these communication sites is that you do not give personal information. You know, you remain anonymous, and that's to allow everybody to feel as comfortable and able to talk freely. Now, you can imagine straight away as a responsible adult, if they're anonymous, they might say anything. So yes, we're very alive to that, and employ moderation, AI moderation, to make sure that's a safe space, and that's a very sort of, you know, a key area of focus for us, to make sure this is a safe and maintained space for them to talk freely without running into problems. But we have very sort of strong, you know, clear guidelines in terms, except, you know, terms and conditions and acceptable use policy for those sites and those forums, at that forum. So really important that they can feel comfortable, go in there, talk about these tricky subjects or areas, but just talk, you know, have open conversation, break down the barriers and the stigma, just make them feel able to really learn and absorb and take that learning to the next level. We also have another quite exciting feature, which is part of it. So you might have noticed a theme of triads, if you like, in our platform. So we have the platform itself, which is the knowledge, you know, which is you go in, learn at your own pace, and you absorb through gamification quizzes and making it fun. You have the community forum where you can talk and expand and further. And we had another aspect, which was gamification, as I mentioned. We wanted to really explore that a lot further, and what we've been able to do sooner than we planned was to create a game associated with this learning. So cast your mind back to role player games. So you're a character on a screen and you're navigating world. So it could be something like Zelda, if you ever played that, or and you are, as a character, will be able to go into a game, or it's a world of itself, and by playing the game you will learn about those basics we talked about, so looking after yourself. So part of the gameplay is to navigate and look after yourself so that you maintain your power bar, for example, or your brain power bar, your happiness bar, your stress index. And if you don't look after it, you will they will deplete, and you'll end up in hospital and you'll need to start the game again. So by playing the game, they have to go and do different tasks, interact with different non-player characters, and learn about these simple aspects of, you know, doing physical activity, eating, you know, to maintain your energy levels. They get to explore further areas within the game. It's a whole world. You'll have to pass certain sort of test points, we call them test temples. So if they go in and answer the tests correctly, they will be able to progress and they'll elevate their status in the game. And those tests and questions are based on the content within the platform. So it sort of promotes them to go into the platform as well and learn the content, because we will tie into the forum, the leaderboard concept, which is very, you know, gaming communities are very sort of, popular with, you know, learning across. So the community and global forum will help build that community space around talking about these subjects, but also with playing the game. So that's where we wanted to truly sort of gamify the learning. And so we think that these three sort of aspects will really sort of power up that, the true learning that comes from that, the absorption of the material, the talking, the going back to it. Because you could fire through our program in a short space of time, but you won't learn it all. You know, and you might not be interested anyway because this isn't relevant to you at this time of your life. So it's there to accompany a young person through their time. And when there something's happening, right, I remember there was something in there about this, or I remember had to go and learn about that for the game, or I remember somebody talking about this in the forum, I'll go back because it's more relevant to me now and I'll learn about it. So it's sort of flexibility to account for everybody's different needs and styles of learning. So we're very excited to offer the game, because that's a very interesting concept.
That's where our glorious employer is going wrong. There is no fire safety role-playing game.
No.
So it sounds to me like you're welcoming schools to this platform now. This is no longer a kind of, you know, an idea. It's out there. We'll yeah. stick loads of things in the show notes. But what should people do if they're sold on any or all of your various triads?
So they go onto our website, essentially, peachwellnessacademy.com, and they can sign up for a free trial if they want to actually explore it and see it and see what some of the modules and the content look like. And from there, the process is quite simple. If they want to onboard their school, then they can just complete that. And then they get access to everything.
Yeah, so it's a form where that will ask the sort of key basics that we would need from a school about their number of students, the number of facilitators, so for their they would need to have access as well. And thinking about the guidance teachers who might be, you know, responsible for these areas of learning. And that they submit that and through the payment gateway, it's, you know, invoice likely payment, and once that clears, we create the school for them, and then that goes back to that lead facilitator to populate their seats, you know, and they can control all that, you know, appreciating that, you know, at the end of a year, a certain number will go off the list and a certain number will come on at the bottom, so they can manage all that, and each student then automatically will get their welcome email to log in and create their registration, which is a very simple process. And away they go.
I would like to point out that obviously some of the more sensitive topics, we found in our research that certain schools don't teach on sex education or want to steer away from any mention of suicide prevention, for example. So we have lumped those sections together, and as part of the onboarding form with a school, we say these are the ones where there's a trigger warning, essentially. And you can toggle them off for your whole school, for certain pupils, or for certain year groups if you're not comfortable for them to have that.
Yeah.
And it's aimed at secondary schools?
Yes.
Yeah. So age 11 to 18.
It's a funny one, because we know obviously the earlier the better with a lot of this. But I mean, the greatest need right now is obviously in secondary schools. And there's a clearer aspect of what should be taught, especially in terms of sexual and reproductive health. But we know that there's, I mean, this is in the future for us. We know that
Peach
there'll be
Wellness
a primary
junior. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. But I don't know. It would need to be designed slightly differently, because less self-directed learning,
I assume.
But we'd need to do a lot more research with primary teachers to understand that better.
There's another podcast episode there, isn't there, about what this looks like for our younger learners.
A primary special. I can tell you've got primary envy, Sean. And also that you'll be filming your next questioning resource in your kitchen.
Definitely, yeah. Maybe I'll get more engagement if I do that.
Thank you so much for that. It only remains to do the notorious homework slots, something interesting and something to try. And since, as usual, I forgot to warn you before the recording that we were doing this, I'm going to be very kind and let you do them in whichever order you prefer. Who'd like to go first?
I'll go first for something interesting. Okay. I'm going to go very light with this because this has been quite a heavy podcast session. Chris and I have been incredibly busy this year, as you can imagine, and quite overwhelmed ourselves. And are at a stage where we don't even know what to read or watch or listen to. A lot of decision fatigue. So last week we watched Last One Laughing UK. And it was wonderful.
Oh, I've seen it. I loved it.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's so good.
I don't know
why
either.
Why does it work?
Because
it
also
totally works.
It's trash TV.
Yeah.
And normally we don't like that, but oh, it really works. They essentially put a group of the UK's best comedians in a house together for 8 hours or something. And the rules are that they're not allowed to laugh, but they have to try and make each other laugh. And the minute they laugh, they're out. And it's just, it's so funny. It's
so
really funny.
You know, I read somewhere that, you know how they've got Jimmy Carr and Roisin, surname I can't remember, watching. Apparently in the original, which was somewhere else, they just had one person in that kind of viewing booth. And they realised that that wasn't very funny because part of what it is that community, that talking to each other. So they've added a second person and apparently the viewings have just gone through the roof. So I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, I'm with you. I loved it.
It also reminded me of being in Sex Ed as a teenager and trying not to laugh. It's funnier when you try not to laugh. So that's why it works. Anyway, and not very highbrow, but for those that want to switch off, definitely good.
But it also gives you a look at those comedians in their life because they're sort of, you know, it's a bit like the old Big Brother idea, you know, where they don't know where all the cameras are and they're just kind of being silly and trying their best and you can see them struggling not to laugh. And it's just really entertaining and it was really good sort of mind dump.
It worked, honestly. I feel like I'd had hours of therapy that night.
Yeah. Right. So I suppose that's my turn. Now, what was it? It was something
to try.
Something to try. Well, yeah, what would I think about that? There's one bit of advice that I like to, when I describe to people, if I was to be asked, if you could only give one piece of medical advice or health advice to everyone and anyone, regardless of age, sex, disability, medical conditions, what would it be? And my answer is try yoga. And yoga, and I say the word yoga and a lot of people think, right, is that on a roll mat, on, you know, doing stretches and things. And whilst that is some of it, yoga is also a wider thing. It appeals much like what we're trying to do to all aspects of, you know, there's the spiritual, there's the mindful, there's the mental, and there's the physical. And there's many different forms of yoga. So it's a great discipline or term to be used for what's quite a broad discipline and, you know, something people can resonate with, whatever their flavor is. So whether they want to do more physical aspects, it can be quite, you know, challenging for strength and balance, or you want to do the more meditative sort of mindful breathing exercises, and you know, it has something for everyone. So and it's also something you can do throughout, you know, from early years all the way to, you know, to the end of years. And I think to me, it's a great symbol of balance and inclusivity and something to really help maintain your health and well-being in all areas. So, yeah.
Oh, I'll definitely try it. Mm. I did yoga, like mum and baby yoga, you know.
So did I.
But mainly for the coffee shop, you know, afterwards. But no, I did really enjoy it, but I've never done it apart from that. So I'll take it. Let's do it. Let's do more yoga.
Yeah.
Yes, I confessed to Emma last year that I quite like the very hot one in a dark pot.
I also did that. Yeah. I did the Bikram yoga for years ago. Yeah, it's fab.
Yeah,
and which is the far end, kind of torture yourself yoga. Yeah. But it teaches a lot of discipline and self-regulation. And yoga essentially means breath. Everything is about breathing. And, you know, they say you're not doing yoga if you're just moving through postures. It's about controlling your breath. If you just sit there and breathe, that's enough.
It helps you to connect your body and your mind and all those aspects that we're hopefully doing as well through our program. And it's actually Susie. I credit Susie for me getting to the Bikram style, and I still do my routines to this day, not necessarily turning the heaters on in the house and sweating up because my energy bill would be through the roof, but I do the practices, and it helps me in all ways, and I love it. So I can't recommend it enough.
There we go. Another episode comes to an end and we are off to do some sun salutations outside the studio. Thank you very much to Chris and Susie Peach. We will put various links in the show notes. It was a really interesting discussion and we will be back with something else in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, thank you everybody and see you in 2 weeks.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Sian Wickersham and Tom Breeze. The special guests this episode were Drs. Chris and Susie Peach from Peach Wellness Academy. You can find the platform they were talking about at peachwellnessacademy.com. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lamburn and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.